Okay, so the people that have done the experiments I'm going to tell you about are listed here. They don't include me. Ian Spielman and Mindy Kellogg are graduate students of mine. Actually, they're both graduating this summer and both going off to do cold atoms instead of cold electrons. So, yeah, I don't know what you want to make of that, but that's the case. Lauren Pfeiffer and Ken West are at Bell Laboratories, and they, of course, are the crystal growers who have fabricated the material on which we get to do experiments. And like the rest of you, we get funding from the NSF and Department of Energy. So I thought I'd start this at a really trivial level to tell you something about excitons that's very old-fashioned to begin with, to sort of serve as introduction to the talk. So here's a semiconductor, gallium arsenide, nice direct gap semiconductor with a green valence band all filled up at zero temperature, no doping, and no electrons in a conduction band. And then my optical friends will come along with photons and shoot them into the sample and make promote electrons up to the conduction band and leave behind some empty states in the valence band. And then they will get out their solid state physics book and they will make a particle hole transformation and talk about electrons and holes. And hopefully, if they are lucky, those electrons and holes will form excitons, and maybe they'll cool off sufficiently, and then maybe they'll Bose condense and do something interesting. One thing worth remembering that they usually forget is that there's an embarrassing relative in the back closet, which of course is the valence band, which is now filled with electrons. So this is where we start in the case of optically generated electron hole plasmas. About a nanosecond later, it's all over, and the electrons and holes have recombined. Now, it's not necessarily a nanosecond if you're smart and you design a proper structure where you can spatially separate the electrons and holes. You can increase that recombination time greatly and hope that the electrons, and when the excitons form, that they have a chance to thermalize, cool down, and if the density is right, maybe Bose condense. And people have been working on this problem for about 40 years. So now, this talk, there are no photons. The experiment and the experimentalists are all in the dark about what's going on. There are no photons at all. However, the situation is more similar than you might imagine. So let's begin. Now, this is a Gedanken example, Gedanken experiment, if you like, or Gedanken theory of what's going on in our experiments. We have two semiconductors, if you like, or two quantum wells, each of which start off, let's say, in this magic condition that I've made, where in one layer, I managed to get an intrinsic semiconductor with no electrons in the conduction band. And in the other layer of the material, this is some kind of sandwich, we dope the system. We don't shoot in any photons. We dope the system in such a way that the Fermi level in this layer is up in the conduction band. So we have some electrons over there. And then we simply throw away the valence bands altogether because they're not going to have any role at all in what I'm going to tell you about today. We don't empty them. We don't do anything with them. We just literally throw them away. And now we put on a magnetic field. We still got this fictitious system where the electrons are all in the conduction band of one of the layers. We put on a certain magnetic field, it's not very high here, in such a way that some number of the Landau levels that are formed in this system are occupied, and some of them are partially occupied, and some of them are empty. The rest of them are empty, like I've indicated here, sort of schematically. We turn the magnetic field a little bit farther until we manage to get one Landau level. I'm forgetting about the spin, so just ignore that detail for the moment. One Landau level is completely occupied in the layer that has electrons in it. Okay, this looks a lot like what I started with the optical guys, except it's turned sideways. You have a filled band over here, which we might call the valence band, and we have a completely empty band, which we might call the conduction band. And if I turned this on its side, it would look exactly the same. And now I come along, not with photons, but with more doping or with gating, depending on how you'd like to do it. And we transfer some particles. We leave the total number of particles the same, but we transfer some particles from one layer of this material into the other layer. Okay, and what have we done? Well, we've got a small population of electrons over here now, and we've got a small population of holes or empty states over in our Landau level. In the original layer, total number of electrons remaining unchanged. And that number of electrons can be essentially arbitrarily small, whatever density you like. And now we do our particle hole transformation exactly the same way we did it back in solid state 101, and we end up with a situation in which we talk about electrons and holes of equal density, but the density can be arbitrarily low. However, there's an embarrassing relative, just like there was in the previous case. There's a filled shell, namely a filled lowest Landau level of electrons in that layer number 2. Okay, so this situation is absolutely identical then. This particle hole transformation is no different than the one that you make thinking about optically generated electron hole plasmas in the case of a bulk semiconductor. And in fact, if I do turn the whole system on its side, it really does look the same. This is the same picture, just turned 90 degrees. Okay? All right, now, so you all know that in a two-dimensional electron gas, you have the quantum Hall effect. You have lots of interesting physics. One thing that you don't have is a quantized Hall state when one Landau level is half filled. And I've tried to indicate that. Again, I'm ignoring the spin degree of freedom. Well, I'm not in this picture. So this Landau level is a lower spin branch of the n equals 0 Landau level when it's half occupied and there's no quantized Hall state there. It's nice straight Hall resistance. However, if we start with a double layer system, which is what we're going to be talking about, then we find that there is a quantum Hall state under exactly that same circumstance. So this situation corresponds to two layers of electrons, each of which is at filling factor 1/2. So the sum, the total filling factor, if you like, is unity. And yes, there is a quantized Hall state at h over e squared. So now, just to make sure everybody's clear about this, the way I'm defining the total filling factor is the sum of the filling factors in the two layers. And the two layers, for the purposes of this talk, you can regard them as being identical. The densities will be the same in the two layers in everything that I tell you about here today. It doesn't have to be that way, but it simplifies things. And there's a quantum Hall state. And we know that if we took these layers and we pulled them far apart, this quantum Hall state would disappear. Okay, so this is something coming about because the layers are close together. And of course, there's both a simple and a complicated explanation for why such a thing could occur. In the simple case, it's just a matter of tunneling of electrons between the two layers. If the barrier is sufficiently thin, then electrons that are in one layer are, of course, in the double layer system are hybridized into symmetric and anisymmetric states like I've drawn here. And that splitting can be quite large if the barrier is sufficiently thin. And then our electrons really are some kind of dumbbell-shaped object. Symmetric state electrons look kind of like dumbbells. And then a nu equal 1 quantized Hall state is perfectly reasonable. It's just a bunch of electrons that look like dumbbells instead of a bunch of electrons that look like little pancakes. Okay, so there's nothing interesting really about that. However, what is interesting is that it's true, and I'm going to be talking about it today, is that even if this splitting between the symmetric and the anti-symmetric states is arbitrarily small, there's still a quantized Hall state. This quantum Hall state does not go away as we take the tunneling strength and make it arbitrarily weak. And just so you know, we can do what you guys would like to do as theorists. We can change the tunneling and leave the layer spacing constant by adjusting the height of the barrier. This is something we can do in terms of the way the sample is grown. We can change the height of this barrier and make the tunneling very, very small. And yet the quantum Hall state still persists, and I'm going to be talking about that state for the rest of the talk. This is a cartoon that I draw of the way this state looks. This is the Jastrow function that Bert Halperin really wrote down many, many years ago now, 20 or 21 years ago, to describe this particular quantum Hall state. The only thing you need to think about at the moment is that, in essence, what's going on in here is there are both intralayer correlations, which I've trivialized to look like every other state is filled in one layer because it's half filled. Same thing is true in the other layer. But there's also interlayer correlations in this state, which are very important. They're just as important as the intralayer correlations, and they are such that an electron in one layer is essentially always opposite a hole in the other layer. That's the built-in correlation that makes this state special. I'll have lots to say about that. Now, there are these two different ways you can understand, as I've tried to indicate, both tunneling and sort of a many-body description. And we established long ago that these things are really continuously related to one another. If we turn the tunneling down somehow smoothly by dint of making many samples, each of which is indicated by a different dot in this phase diagram, this is the strength of the tunneling, this is the spacing between the layers, we find that there's a phase diagram. As the tunneling increases, the amount of phase space, if you like, where there is a quantum Hall state becomes very large. It's very easy to get a quantum Hall state if there's a lot of tunneling. But if the tunneling is very weak, the phase space doesn't disappear entirely. It just goes down to some minimal amount. And that's when many body effects are stabilizing the state almost entirely. And today's talk is going to be done along this vertical axis. In these units of symmetric anti-symmetric splitting, in units of the mean Coulomb energy, you see these numbers are around a few percent or so. What I'm going to be talking about today is about a part per million. So we're really very, very close to the vertical axis. one is never on it, but you can get very close to it.
Jim, for that figure, the tunneling is just calculated by the overlap matrix element, right?
Well, it depends. In some of these samples, the ones that are more strongly tunneling, like out here, you can actually measure it directly in the Shubnikov-Dehaas beating pattern, so you can measure it. And then when it gets down here, it becomes very hard to measure, and then we calculate it. And, you know, we could talk, you understand there are complexities in that calculation. And in the case where the tunneling strength is a part per million of the Coulomb energy, we absolutely calculate it. It's hopeless to try to measure it directly. It's way too small, it's microvolts. Okay, so this is an example of a sample in which the tunneling strength is very, very weak. It's a very tall barrier. It's 100 angstroms wide, which is enormous on the scale of things here. We have to work at very low densities in order for this to become strongly correlated. The tunneling, the S is, as Shankar was just asking, the calculated tunneling strength is about 100 microkelvin in this sample. I should warn you all that, as I often do and people tend to forget, is that these numbers are extremely squishy. They're very hard to know, really, what is the tunneling matrix element. And the reason is that you have to ask yourself, well, what effective, I mean, it's, you know, it's kindergarten quantum mechanics. What effective mass do you put in when you make your tunneling matrix element inside the barrier layer? You're about a volt below the conduction band and about, I don't know, 2 volts above the valence band. What effective mass do you use there? Not obvious. And depending on what you use, it makes a huge difference in this number. What we've done to calculate this is just assume it's gallium arsenide everywhere, which is surely false. And it probably overestimates the tunneling strength substantially. But it's a simple-minded estimate. Anyway, this sample, which has very weak tunneling, part per million of the Coulomb energy, shows the quantum Hall state. There's the minimum in the resistivity. There it is being thermally activated. I don't show the Hall plateau here, but there is one. If I had it convenient, I would have put it on here. For this talk, then, the phase diagram that we can think about is one-dimensional. There are several other dimensions which are interesting, too, but we're going to talk really about one, which is the spacing between the layers. And what I'm telling you is that there is a critical point. If the layer spacing is above that critical point, there is no quantized Hall phase. And if it's below that critical point, there is one. And at the moment, all I've done is to tell you that it's either a quantum Hall effect or it's not a quantum Hall effect, not whether it's got any other interesting attributes. Okay, well, it does have other interesting attributes, many, and that's why I've been working on it for 10 years, I think. It's fascinating, absolutely fascinating. So here is the beginning of what, let me try to describe for you what is some of the interesting physics that goes on in this system. In the limit of no tunneling, which is basically where we are, although not exactly, you can think of the ground state of this system. This Jastrow function that I wrote down was related to this particular way of writing the wave function here. It's very closely related to it. But you can think of the ground state in the following way. The system chooses, because it can lower its correlation energies, for each electron to decide, rather than being in one layer or the other, in spite of the fact there's very little tunneling, to go into a linear superposition of layer, let's say layer blue and layer red, which we can label with a pseudospin index. Electrons decide to go into a linear combination of up layer and down layer, so you no longer know what layer they're in. And there's some phase relationship in here. Okay, if the tunneling were dominant in the system, this phase would be zero. All electrons would be in the symmetric state. And if the tunneling were strong enough, there would be nothing interesting to talk about. Okay, the point is this continues to be true, even in the limit of very, very weak tunneling. This picture is really a magnetism picture. The electrons have a pseudo-magnetization or a pseudo-spin which lies in the XY plane, or it doesn't actually lie in the XY plane, but it lies close to the XY plane. It does fluctuate out of the plane a little bit. But it's close to the XY plane, and it's inclined by some angle phi, in this simple example, with respect to the X-axis in pseudo-spin space. And of course, the energy of the system is independent of that angle phi, in the limit of no tunneling. If there is some tunneling, the angle likes to be zero, but maybe that energy is very, very small. Okay. Gradients in this phase do, however, give you energies. There is a spin stiffness associated with gradients in the phase. That spin stiffness, the gradients of the phase, can be regarded, if you like, in terms of pseudo-spin currents, which are dissipationless in this system. Okay, and I'm going to tell you more about this from a different perspective in a little while. Now, this was the picture that one had quite some time ago, back in 94 or so, developed in part at least because of this experiment, which was done by Sheena Murphy, who was a postdoc of mine. I don't have time to talk about this in any detail. But the bottom line in this experiment is that what we did was we measured the strength of the quantized Hall state that I'm talking about, this nu equal 1 quantized Hall state, as a function of an additional magnetic field applied parallel to the layers. And what we found was a very curious thing that no one had expected, and it was completely unpredicted, was that the energy gap for this quantum Hall state dropped very rapidly for a very small amount of applied magnetic field between the two layers and then stopped changing. Didn't stop changing completely, but it clearly went into a different behavior at around 8 degrees of tilt. So this very strong sensitivity was a real mystery when it was discovered. Turns out it has a relatively natural explanation in terms of this pseudospin model or this quantum Hall ferromagnetism model. If the system is at zero parallel magnetic field, the pseudospins are all lined up, and in fact they do line up along the x-axis because there is some tunneling. So they line up along the symmetric state direction. And as you apply parallel magnetic field, that changes the phase relationship of electrons in the two layers with respect to one another. And in order to maintain yourself in the symmetric state, you have to have the pseudospin now tumble transverse to the magnetic field. And there's a length scale for that, which is determined only by the parallel field. But as the system tumbles in its effort to maintain the advantage of being in symmetric states, it loses on this pseudospin stiffness. It loses exchange energy, and eventually that loss of exchange energy becomes prohibitive, and there's a commensurate incommensurate phase transition. So this was a very nice result because it was very stimulating, if you like, to the theory of quantum Hall ferromagnetism. Had a lot to do with the development of that picture. Now, yeah.
How big are those values experimentally?
What values?
The critical value
of.
In terms of length scale.
Oh, okay, fine. So. Around, I don't remember the precise numbers, we can sit down and make them, but somewhere in here, around halfway down, the number comes out to be that if you take this Q and invert it, it's around 2,000 angstroms. So it's a long length scale compared to the interparticle separation, but it's clearly short compared to the size of the sample. Okay, so it is fairly small length scale physics, but larger than interparticle separation. And this was the first, actually, that's a good point. This was strong evidence that there were long coherence lengths in the system. Okay, now, if we take a different point of view, we can make this particle hole transformation nonsense that I talked about at the very beginning, where we start thinking about, before the photons are applied, if you like, one layer being completely empty and one layer being completely full, or the lowest lambda level of the two layers being in that situation, and transferring half of the particles from one layer to the other. Now, it needn't be half, as I tried to indicate at the beginning, but I will stick with the situation where we do transfer half the particles for this talk. It does not have to be half. So in that situation, we have our two half-filled lambda levels, and now the way to talk about it is a half-filled layer of electrons and a half-filled layer of holes plus a filled lambda level. The point is that in a magnetic field, the chance of getting exciton condensation like this is no different for electron-electron systems than it is for electron-hole systems. That's the important point that I've tried to make. So that same wave function that I wrote down for you a minute ago with the symmetric combinations of up and down can be written as in this sort of quasi-BCS form where we make where we have an exciton creation operator and then some phase multiplying that. Looks just like a BCS function with the exception that the coherence factors U and V are both equal to 1 over root 2 in this case. They're equal to 1 over root 2 because there isn't any kinetic energy in the magnetic field problem. Every electron is the same. They're all in the lowest lambda level. There's no Fermi surface anymore. So all electrons participate in the Cooper pairing, if you like, in precisely the same way as all other electrons. So this is a difference between this system and a superconductor at zero magnetic field. The U's and the V's are all equal to unity, or 1 over root 2. Now we can talk about gradients in the phase. It's the same phase, but now we talk about them as supercurrents, excitonic supercurrents. So let me tell you about those a little bit more. This quantum Hall state, and this is why it's interesting and why I fooled around with it for so long, does more than the quantum Hall effect by a lot. So the quantum Hall effect is something that you measure by putting currents in the two layers and putting them in parallel and looking for the Hall resistance and looking for the longitudinal resistance and seeing what happens and trying to understand the nature of the quasi-particle gap and so on and so forth. All of that goes through, and there's a very pretty picture. It's a picture. It's not something that's been verified of what the charged excitations in the system are supposed to be like. They are vortex-like excitations in the pseudospin field, which in the quantum Hall systems are charged, and they have a charge of half of an electron. This is, if you like, a theoretical party line. It's not something that's seen in an experiment. These guys pair up, the vortices pair up, and you get Meyron-anti-Meyron pairs, which have a net charge of E. These are believed to be the charged excitations of the quantum Hall state. Okay, these things would, for example, live near the edge of the, or transport current near the edge of the sample in the standard way you would think about in the quantum Hall effect. Okay, they're exotic, but Really, it's just quantum Hall physics. And there would be dissipation in this system that's thermally activated, because there's some energy for creating this quasi-particle that you need to supply. Now, on the other hand, this system has a condensate. So there's also a transport mechanism in the condensate. And this is something which is not true in any other quantum Hall state that I know about, at least none that's been experimentally studied. There's another way to transport current, if you like, or something analogous to current. You can transport excitons in the condensate. It's a little bit like a two-fluid model. There's something going on. There's a superfluid component, if you like, comprised of these excitons. We can imagine doing something with an exciton, which I've drawn as a cartoon here, and transporting it off here to the right like this. And that's something which will cost some amount of kinetic energy, but it's not a charged excitation. Not something you'll see in a quantum Hall effect experiment. And indeed, you can understand that very trivially, because if I transport the excitons off to the right here, no net charge is being transported anywhere. That's equivalent to saying that there's an electrical current moving to the left in the top layer and to the right in the bottom layer. Okay. That's a mode of transport which exists in this system, which is not present in other quantum Hall states. That's exciton transport in the condensate. That's what's exciting about this system. Okay? And if you believe the theoretical party line, what you would hope to see is that there would be some Coster-Lefthouse transition temperature, which one calculates to be of order a few tenths of a degree, and below that temperature you would find zero dissipation in linear response. That's what you would expect. So the interesting place to work for this quantum Hall system is not to look at the quantum Hall effect. It's to look at things in the antisymmetric channel. That's where the interesting physics is. In other words, you would like to be able to grab onto the excitons and move them and see what they do. Or you might like to do something, another thing that's antisymmetric is take a charge and move it from one layer to the other. And what I want to talk to you about today is these experiments, not the quantum Hall effect. Both of these. Now, let's start with tunneling. So tunneling, we've again been doing for a long time. It's not all that hard. What you have to do is be able to make connections to the individual layers that attach wires and hook up batteries and ammeters and stuff like that and do the measurement. And it can be done. Okay, we've been doing it for a long time. It took us a long time to reach the point where we could do it in a strongly correlated system. But the basic idea we've had accessible for quite some time. An important point is to remember the following, is that when we grow a sample, of course, it has a fixed layer separation between these two layers, and we would like to be able to vary that, and we can't vary it in a single sample. So what we do is to vary the density of electrons instead. The thing that matters about the strength of whether the interlayer interaction is relevant or not is the relative size of the interlayer interaction to the intralayer interaction. So by lowering the density, we can make a particular layer thickness appear to be thin rather than thick. The thing that's important is the ratio of the layer separation to the average electron separation or the magnetic length at filling factor 1. Either measure would be fine. And so we can do that by electrostatic gating. We can continuously move our sample along on the phase boundary and cross, go back and forth between the two phases in a single sample at low temperatures. This is very important. Much, much harder to do these experiments if you had to make different samples all the time and try to compare one to the next. Okay. So in tunneling, this is what you see. If you start with the sample positioned above the critical point, the tunneling conductance is it's a very interesting piece of physics. Many of you know a lot about it, probably more than I, that there's a suppression of the tunneling conductance around zero bias, which is a many-body effect itself. You're trying to tunnel from a half-filled Landau level into a half-filled Landau level. Your first thing you would say is, oh, that should tunnel just fine. Once you bring them on resonance with one another, there's a good density, there's some density of states in both layers. It's probably pretty large. There should be a big joint density of states. You should get a lot of tunneling conductance. Well, you don't get any tunneling conductance. And the reason is the system is very strongly correlated. If you try to take an electron and tunnel it from one layer to the other, if you like, it has no idea what's going on in the layer it's about to enter. It's completely uncorrelated. And the minimum amount of energy that you need to get in there is basically the Coulomb energy. This is a Coulomb gap phenomenon. It has to do with correlations in the individual layers, not correlations between the layers. It's very interesting, but it's not germane to what I'm about to show you, which is this. If you take the same sample and you move it, by this gating technique, from this point to this point, now it's below the critical point, which is, we knew where it was, obviously, ahead of time. And now the tunneling spectrum changes very dramatically. Instead of it being hard to tunnel between the two layers, it becomes very, very easy. The tunneling conductance at zero bias is very large. In fact, this is one of our earlier data sets that it's in fact far, far larger than this if we do the experiment properly. It was not being done properly here. But you can nevertheless see the qualitative effect quite clearly. There's a big change as you cross this phase boundary, and this was a complete surprise to, it sure was to me anyway. This effect of this enhancement is particular to the filling factor 1 situation. In other words, when you're in this state where it's half plus half or 60 plus 40 or 70, 30, whatever, total filling factor is 1. That's when this effect occurs. This is the conductance at zero bias measured as a function of magnetic field. If you're at zero magnetic field, there's a conductance. It's ordinary tunneling between two-dimensional conductors, and then there's some Shubnikov-de-Haas oscillations, and then this suppression effect, this Coulomb gap sets in well below a Tesla and just wipes out the tunneling conductance until you hit this exotic state, and then boom, up goes the tunneling conductance by some orders of magnitude, and then it comes back down again. So this is definitely a filling factor 1 phenomenon. At the same time, as a function of temperature, the height of this peak is very, very small at high temperatures and then explodes at low temperatures, becomes very large as the temperature is reduced. If you weren't in this quantum Hall state, if you had the density on the other side of the phase boundary, you would have found that the suppression, this Coulomb gap effect, just, this is now multiplied by 200 to be able to see what's going on, just gets exponentially smaller and smaller and smaller. This is a very different phenomenon. It's occurring right at nu equal to 1. Okay. So when you do start doing the experiment more carefully, you find the following. You find that this resonance in the tunneling conductance is extremely sharp. So this is an example of some data that Ian obtained in which the line width for the tunnel resonance is now down to around a microvolt, between 1 and 2 microvolts, is about the minimum that we've ever seen. So this is extremely small. It's much, much smaller than the lifetime than the number you would expect based on the lifetime of electrons, let's say from the Shubnikov-de-Haas oscillations or from the mobility, whatever you like. This is much, much narrower than that. This is very suggestive that there's a collective mode in this system. One way to think about this, and this is a cartoon view, is that but it's good for me, is that as an electron tunnels from one layer to the other, you create a deficit of charge in the layer from which it has to leave, and you create an excess of charge in the layer into which it's about to enter. And those charge defects have to relax. And in fact, in the situation where the layers were far apart, it was the slowness of that relaxation that was very, very important in producing that Coulomb gap. Things get bottled up because, if you put this excess charge in one layer and it tries to relax, there's this big magnetic field on it, starts to go around in a circle, it just gets slowed down enormously. But here, the layers are strongly coupled. And so now, in order to relax these defects, I have to move away from the excess charge in one layer and I have to move in the other layer. And that's exciton transport. That's counterflow. And that's what's supposed to be special in this system. So maybe that's what this is telling you. If you look at the height and the width of this tunnel resonance as a function of temperature, you see some things which we don't understand. For example, the height in the best data that we have seems to be exponential in temperature, not activated, but kind of exponential, e to the minus t over tau. Okay, you can see it there. Don't really know what happens at 5 millidegrees, but can only go to about 15 or 20 millidegrees. It's very suggestive that things are still happening down here. The line width seems to be quadratic in temperature. Whether it saturates at the lowest possible temperatures or not, I don't know. I mean, 1 microvolt's about the limit that we've been able to tell how narrow this line becomes. If it's going to saturate, it has to be smaller than a microvolt, and it has to do it below about 25 or 20 millikelvin, and I don't know the answer to whether there's a finite width at zero temperature or not. This is the best we've been able to do. Now, I've told you or suggested that this is related to a collective mode. Of course, there is a Goldstone mode in this system. If you think in this pseudo-spin picture, you've got this magnetization. It's in the limit of no tunneling anyway. It would be independent of the angle phi, so there's a continuously broken symmetry. So if there were no tunneling, there would be a collective mode that went to zero energy. In fact, of course, it is gapped ever so slightly because there is a little bit of tunneling. That gap is very tiny. So the picture looks roughly like this, but there is, in fact, a gap down there. Our tunneling experiment, in some sense, detects this mode near zero energy. That's what we're seeing when we see this sharp resonance. So to prove that, or to demonstrate that that's at least plausible, we've done magnetotunneling spectroscopy to try to measure the slope of this curve. Okay, so this is what's predicted to be present, and we wanted to measure the velocity of this collective mode. And we've done that now by doing...
The gap that you mentioned.
Sorry?
You said there is a small gap.
Yes.
Wouldn't that show up somehow too?
Well, Number one, I have no idea how big it is. I mean, we have a theoretical idea of how big it is, but we don't, and that number comes out to be quite small, some tens of millikelvins or so. So it's small. We're measuring tunneling. And so we're measuring, if you like, the thing which it is that produces this gap. And with no tunneling, we would have nothing, we would have no gap, but we would also have nothing to measure. So I'm not, if you want, I have a confusion here about how to understand tunneling in the, how to understand this gap in the presence of tunneling. But this is what we're measuring. We're using tunneling, if you like, as a very weak probe to go and sample this spectrum. There is some gap there. What happens when the, if you look at voltages small compared to that gap, I think is, well, we don't know. We see ohmic, if we go to the top of the tunnel resonance, we look at very, very small voltages around there. It's ohmic. This is the central problem, is what value should it be, and how should it behave as you look at energy smaller than that gap? People, as I understand, don't understand this problem.
Can you look at samples in which the tunneling is larger, if you want to explore that region?
We could, and we have not done that. It becomes, for that gap to become, if it becomes noticeable, the tunneling is going to be so strong that we can't actually do the measurement any longer. So we're kind of between a rock and a hard place. We need to have very, very weak tunneling in order to establish a separate context to make the measurement. So it's a bit of a problem. It's a good question. I don't know how better to answer it. Anyway, so what we're... I get confused here with my little button. So we're doing magnetotunneling spectroscopy. Again, it's similar to the experiment that Sheena Murphy did. We put a parallel field on that changes our phase relationship between the two layers, gives us a wave vector. We now should be able to sample the tunneling spectral density at finite Q rather than Q equal to zero. And that Q is tunable because we know the layer separation, we know the parallel magnetic field. We should see sidebands. As the mode disperses linearly in energy, or linearly in wave vector, we should be able to pick up sidebands. And lo and behold, we do. They're very weak. We do pick up sidebands. There they first are, and then they move outward. But you notice there's still a pretty strong central peak. If you look at it on a coarser scale, there's this gigantic central peak. It comes crashing down. And if you could look inside here, you would see these things, these very small subbands. And they're dispersing outward. But the central peak is strong and is present. Okay, and this is a puzzle, actually. So what do you get if you look at the dispersion of those sidebands? You get these data points here, which give you a collective mode velocity that's about 15 kilometers per second, which is within a factor of 2 of most theoretical estimates of this number. So it's reasonable. We believe we've got the right spin stiffness. We don't know why the curve looks the way that it did, that those resonances were so weak and that the central peak remained present while we added this parallel magnetic field. Okay? But one idea that you can kind of imagine is, well, let me do the following. Let me go here first. And I'll come back to it. One thing you can imagine is that instead of the sample being homogeneous over the size of the entire chip, which is maybe 200 microns on a side, maybe we just have very, very small regions which are phase coherent because of disorder, and they're all somehow adding up to give the total response of the sample, but that the actual coherence length is actually very short, something like maybe a micron or so. If that were the case, it would be relatively easy to try to at least bullshit your ways, pardon my French, to understanding why this peak remains present. We would instead expect then to see a drop-off in this peak, which was dictated not by the size of the sample, which would be extremely rapid, but by the size of these little coherent regions. So if we look at the height of this peak, my laser pointer seems to be dying here, when watch how it decays away, it looks like this. This is B parallel from zero, plus or minus fields around zero. It's come kind of Lorentzian shape. We take the width of this, we can come up with a number for the coherence length. Okay, and that number comes up to be of order, a few tenths of a micron or so. Okay, so one way to sort of understand this very vaguely is that the system is heavily disordered and the regions that are contributing to the tunneling are really no bigger than a few tenths of a micron in size. It's a little bit like the problem of the interference pattern in a Josephson junction. Okay, it's very, very similar to that. If you imagine smearing a bunch of Fraunhofer patterns from different size Josephson junctions, you can get a picture that looks like this, and you can from that estimate how big those junctions are, and you'll get this number of a few tenths of a micron. Okay, I didn't make that very clear, but okay. Now let me go backwards and show you what the IV curves look like as you're doing this experiment. This is a family of IV curves. which have been highlighted in red near zero bias, just so that you can see how spectacular they are. The curves in the back are for densities such that the sample is on the compressible side of the phase boundary, and there's no excitonic state, no quantum Hall state, if you like. Tunneling current is heavily suppressed. That's this Coulomb gap. And as you lower the spacing between the layers, this is now L over D, this phenomenon turns on. You get this peak arising in a continuous fashion. There doesn't appear to be any abrupt jump. It just kind of comes up and grows very, very rapidly as you decrease the spacing between the layers. Looks like a step in the IV curve. It's kind of reminiscent of the Josephson effect. So the question then is it in fact a Josephson effect? Is it in fact a Josephson effect? And the answer is no, because at least experimentally, it's not zero. It's not an infinitely narrow jump in the IV curve, as far as we can tell experimentally. We've done our best on this, and the number that we get is maybe a microvolt. That's what I told you about before. So as far as we can tell, it's not really a Josephson effect, but maybe it's supposed to be. I mean, one doesn't know. We have to do more experiments and see if we can figure out this question. One thing you do know, though, is if you make this most simple-minded estimates of how big the Josephson energy ought to be, from what we know about this system and the calculated values of the symmetric anti-symmetric splitting, you get numbers that would suggest that the critical current for this Josephson junction would be very large, like 50 microamps. And even if I'm wrong about delta SAS by a factor of 10, it's still some microamps. Okay, and we measure picoamps. That's six orders of magnitude. Okay, so something's, I mean, really not right about this picture. And my own gut feeling is that aside, the question of whether it's really a Josephson junction or not is kind of almost beside the point. The thing that's important is the system is not homogeneous. It's heavily disordered. I think this is something that really needs to be thought about very seriously. These systems are very strongly disordered.
What area do you
get? Six orders of magnitude smaller. I mean, you got to ask yourself how the different regions add together. So I don't really know the answer. Maybe it's six orders of magnitude. Maybe it's a square root of six orders of magnitude. I don't remember. I don't know.
There are these objects which are highly overdamped Josephson junction. I mean, I showed this to some of my colleagues, so, you know, bad Josephson junction people. And they said this is not that far from overdamped Josephson junction.
It's true. I mean, I got an education on this from Michel Devoret once about overdamped Josephson junctions. I don't know much about these things, but it's certainly true that if you have phase diffusion in a Josephson junction, you can get finite conductance at zero bias. And maybe that's what's going on. However, once again, if you try to estimate how big this Josephson energy is, you find out that it's so much smaller than KT that the sharpness of this IV curve just doesn't make sense. I mean, it's something's not right about that. At least at zero order, it's not right about that picture. All right. Let me now switch gears and, yeah, Xiaogang.
Yeah, I wonder whether the complicated element may not have the same sign. So probably the other one with the same sign is an overestimate.
Well, I think that's probably right. I think that the pseudospin in these different domains is just all messed up all across the sample. Some places tunneling up, some places tunneling down. Absolutely.
Do you think that the apparent second order nature of this transition is then a disorder effect? I mean, what would have been a first order transition using sphere now?
Matthew, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. There's nothing that we have done that looks, well, actually, that's not quite true. Well, toward the end of the talk, I'll get to that. There are some things deconfined in our lab, but it's not that. Let me switch gears now to a different measurement probe, because I want to get to exciton transport. So Mindy Kellogg is not doing tunneling, or her thesis was on transport experiments, in particular counterflow and drag transport experiments. A drag experiment, for those of you that don't know, is a very simple thing, in principle at least. You put a current in one layer and you measure a voltage in the other layer. And by friction, if you like, between the two layers, a voltage appears in the second layer. This is something which is a very cute experiment. And is very nice because it tells you directly in a resistance measurement what is the strength of electron-electron interactions between the two layers. That's neat. I mean, normally, you know, you think, I don't want to waste your guys' time. You know what you think about electron-electron interactions and transport. They're hard to see. Here it comes out directly. So In the magnetic field, we make two measurements, of course. We make a longitudinal drag measurement and a transverse or Hall drag measurement. And here's what we see. So this picture is actually the conventional quantum, the conventional parallel transport resistivity, Shubnikov-de-Haas and quantum Hall states, just demonstrating that we have a nice deep minimum at filming factor 1. The quantum Hall state is present. When we measure the longitudinal drag, we find that it also vanishes. In other words, this friction, if you want to call it friction, vanishes as you reach the quantum Hall state. And that's not surprising. There's an energy gap in the system. Maybe it's these Meron-anti-Meron pairs. That governs the rate at which things can dissipate, energy can be dissipated, and you expect the longitudinal component of the drag to vanish at low temperatures. Nothing surprising about this. What's surprising is that in the Hall channel, you normally don't expect, at zero order, you don't expect, I know Ben Hu is in the audience, but at zero order, you don't expect any Hall drag at all. Okay, why is that? Well, there's no current flowing in the layer that you're measuring the drag voltage in, so there's no drift velocity. If there's no drift velocity, there's no Lorentz force. If there's no Lorentz force, there's no Hall effect. Okay, that's not quite true, but it's a good approximation to say that. And indeed, at low magnetic fields, there is no Hall drag. It's just gone. But when you reach this state, there is something. And in fact, it's very large, and it reaches around 25 kilo-ohms. And if you look carefully, of course, it reaches H over E squared, and it's accurately quantized. So the voltage that you see in the layer that's not carrying any current is actually the same as the Hall voltage you would have expected if there was, if it was carrying current, which makes you initially very suspicious that, in fact, it is carrying current. You don't know it. So you have to do some experiments and make sure that you know what you're talking about. But it's true that there was no current carrying, no current flowing in this layer, and yet the voltage that's present there is H over E squared times the current in the layer that is carrying current. It's an odd result. Okay? So what I've told you, how much?
Well, you're already over.
I'm already over? That's it. That's terrible. Okay. Let's see. So.
Well, there were questions. So.
Let me. Yeah. So you can subtract those from my 20 minutes.
Just keep quiet.
Let me do the following. Let me leave this.
No.
Just go back. You've done it already, and it's done now. So.
Everyone wants to hear
it.
Why penalize us for
this? All right, I'll go back quickly.
Exactly.
All I wanted to say to you, and this is sort of a preface to the counterflow measurements, is that if we do in fact drive current in one layer, this is neither of these two special modes of transport, right? One is quantum Hall transport where the current is in parallel, and the other is this anti-symmetric currents where you're driving excitons. We're not doing either one when we do Coulomb drag. We're doing some linear superposition, 50-50, in fact, of these two things. So in some sense, the way to think about the drag experiment is that when you inject the current into one layer, there is a symmetric current flowing in the other layer, but there's also a piece of anti-symmetric current flowing in that layer in such way that the boundary conditions are met, that you get no net current flowing. You don't know what the distribution of these two things are, but the total sum of current in the gray layer here has to add up to zero. The reason that's an interesting way to look at it is that if, in fact, there is a symmetric current being carried by charged quasiparticles that's the same in the two layers, then, of course, you'll see a Hall resistance which is the same in the two layers. Okay? Charged quasiparticles are flowing in both layers. The anti-symmetric current's not carrying any charge, so it doesn't contribute anything to the Hall resistance. So you expect to see quantized Hall resistance from this kind of way of looking at things. You expect to see quantized Hall drag. I'll skip that one. Now, what we would rather do, though, is this measurement. This measurement is what Mindy really finished up her thesis with, which is to drive currents in opposition in the two layers. Okay, so there's a lot of wires attached to this experiment. The bottom line, though, is it looks kind of like this cartoon where I drive a current, let's say, through the top layer in this direction with the yellow arrow. I bring it out of the sample. It goes up into the room, by the way. We measure it to make sure we have all the current we thought we had, that it didn't tunnel in some place and sneak from one layer to the other and really make for totally incorrect results. And then we bring it back in and we drive it back in the opposite direction. Okay? That's the experiment. And that, in principle, is exciting only the anti-symmetric exciton transport. Okay? That's what you would hope.
The blue and the yellow are in different layers.
Yeah, they're in different layers. Those two are in different layers.
And then you measure what? Sorry.
Whatever you like. So we can measure, let's say we measure the voltage from here to here, which would be the Hall voltage, and we can measure it in one of the layers or in the other layer. We do one at a time. Okay, we don't short the layers together. We have complete control over where we attach wires.
And longitudinal.
And longitudinal, same way. There. Okay. Okay. This is only half of the gates that are on the sample. The other half are on the back that you can't see. This picture is unfortunately not taken. It would be just horrible. So many pieces to it. So here's the cartoon. Cartoon is, if you do this experiment, here's the idea. You're driving current in one layer, returning it through the other layer in the opposite direction, and you're measuring the Hall voltage in the first layer. So what do you see? Function of magnetic field. The Hall effect. It goes up linearly in field. I'm ignoring the quantum Hall effect. All quantum effects have been ignored. It just goes up linearly with field. The second layer doesn't do anything. If you had two pieces of metal and you made this experiment in the lab, you wouldn't see anything but what I've drawn in this picture. Okay, now if you move the voltage probes down to the other layer, obviously you see the same physics but with opposite sign for the Hall voltage. No surprise. Okay, this is the starting point, what you should expect. However, if you reach a special magnetic field where the system goes into this excitonic state and the two currents are not independent of one another, in other words, you're dragging excitons along. Excitons are charge neutral. The Hall effect's going to vanish in both layers separately. That's the prediction. Okay, so it's a very blunt prediction. And this is what you see. So this is the Hall effect. Now I've got to include all the other quantum Hall states that occur that are not so interesting for us today. These, all these different nice little steps. But then we reach the filling factor 1 state, and the Hall resistance in the top layer vanishes. Okay, it becomes very, very small. It doesn't vanish. It becomes very, very small. In the limit of low temperatures, it becomes very, very small. What this tells us very directly is that at this magnetic field, for this particular value of the density, when the layers are sufficiently close together, these two currents are not independent of one another. They're carried as the counterflow mode, which is a uniform flow of charge-neutral excitons. The net Hall resistance vanishes. This experiment is very, very, very directly confirms that.
Yep. You have also the inelastic scattering net last connection there, right? So it's not as in that loop between the two layers, the black line.
Oh, sure. And in the contacts all over the place.
So somehow the electrons are timing themselves.
Well, you know, what goes on, how the exciton dies right here and jumps out into the wire and runs into, I don't know about that.
You're heating the electrons up in that connection.
Something's happening there, absolutely. Absolutely, but the voltage probes are far removed from that spot. That's a good point. I mean, there's something goes on there which we don't understand. But in the interior of the device, this is excitons flowing in one direction. Okay. And at the same time as you measure this in the transverse channel, if you look in the longitudinal channel, not surprisingly, you see zero again, or something very, very small. So this is unusual for the quantum Hall effect. What is the phenomenon of the quantum Hall effect? Hall resistance is quantized at some multiple of h over e squared, and the longitudinal resistance vanishes. That's quantum Hall effect. Here, both those things are true, except the quantization of the Hall resistance is at zero. Both resistances have gone to zero. You've got a 2 Tesla magnetic field on, and all four components of the resistivity tensor vanish in counterflow. This is a dramatic result. If you think about it in terms of conductivity, right, you would calculate this ratio to get the conductivity. I mean, this is sort of just restating what I've already told you. If you're in the quantum Hall state doing normal parallel transport, resistivity RxX vanishes, RxY remains large and finite, sigma XX vanishes. That was my first great disappointment when I learned about the quantum Hall effect many years ago, was that it was not a superconductor. In fact, it was an insulator. It was very disappointing. But now it is, because now I have the situation where both the numerator and the denominator are vanishing. And so I have to actually ask in detail, what is the ratio doing? Right? What really is going on as temperature goes to zero? And so the best we can do is to work hard and try to measure those resistances carefully as a function of temperature. And I'm out of time, so there's a lot of interesting things we don't understand about these graphs, but the basic idea is that in counterflow, the red curve is the Hall resistance, the blue one is the longitudinal resistance, they're both vanishing as the temperature goes to zero. Normal quantum Hall transport in the parallel channel. If we calculate conductivity from these numbers, just by inverting that tensor, we get this picture. Conductivity in the parallel channel does what it normally does in the quantum Hall effect. The conductivity in the counterflow channel rises continuously as the temperature is reduced. In fact, it becomes so large, it's even an order of magnitude larger than it is at zero magnetic field, thousands of times larger than E squared over H. Okay, so very high conductivity. It's not infinite, but it's very high. What it's doing below 30 millikelvin, I don't know. All right, well, let me finish now. So these are the two things that we've really seen.
Can you just go back? How does it go to 1,000 over H?
Well, this is in units of E squared over H. So it's of order 1,000. Yeah, it's a pretty good conductor. Pretty good conductor, that's right. Six orders of magnitude larger than in the quantum Hall channel. It's a very dramatic effect. So what we've seen is that two main things that I've told you about. One is this enormous anomaly in tunneling. And what I think that anomaly tells you is that the system is becoming phase coherent, at least on some length scale that's large compared to the interparticle separation, but not large on the scale of the sample, small on the scale of the sample, determined almost certainly by disorder. At the same time, we've done these transport measurements, which I think convincingly show that these excitons are present. Now, I gave this talk at our similar talk a couple of weeks ago at an optics conference where people were talking largely about optically generated electron hole plasmas. And one of the things that somebody asked me was, well, they have a very different perspective. They start with excitons. And then they hope that things cool off and the excitons condense. We don't do that. This is much more like superconductivity. There aren't any Cooper pairs above the transition. They're there and they all do their thing at once. Well, how do you know they're doing anything unusual? It's not just a gas of excitons that's giving you this quantum Hall resistance, or this Hall resistance being zero. And the point here, I think, is that if that were true, this is very different than metallic conduction of these excitons. As you're going to lower temperatures, not only does the Hall resistance vanish, but the conductivity of these things is going up and up and up as the temperature goes down. Not like a metal where you have electrons scattering off of impurities that saturate conductivity at low temperatures. This conductivity is diverging in the low temperature limit. So there are a lot of puzzles, many questions you can ask that we don't know the answer to. You've asked some of them already. The tunneling conductance is too weak. We don't understand why. We don't know what the width of it is and why it is what it is. This business of what happens in the parallel field and how strong those satellites are is a mystery, why they're as weak as they are. We would have expected Coster-Litz-Thallus physics in an ideal world. We would have had some temperature of order a couple tenths of a Kelvin. And we believe we know the spin stiffness from independent measurements to suggest that's really what it is. It is of that order. So there should be some temperature below which the conductivity becomes very nonlinear in current. And we don't see any of that. All we see is ohmic conduction, but the resistance going to zero, the conductivity going to infinity as the temperature is reduced. Okay, so from that perspective, the Coster-Litz-Thallus temperature is zero, or it's below our lowest temperature, in spite of the fact that the spin stiffness comes out to be the right value. And we don't understand that. So, I mean, this is sort of a tautology. There must be, in one way of thinking, the disorder in the system must somehow be nucleating or allowing there to be present at low temperatures free vortices. And these free vortices must be drifting around in the sample, and in particular, moving in response to counterflow. Right, there's a Magnus force on these vortices. They will tend to move if they're not strongly pinned, and so you will get longitudinal voltages from these things and deviations in the Hall resistance from these things, dissipation. But like I say, it's kind of a tautology. It's kind of content-free. This is what has to be true, but we don't know why. So this is the last view graph just to show you that you can build an exciton condensate in a sneaky way. You don't have to have lasers and wait and hope that things cool off in a nanosecond. You can build it all by doping. And what the only price you have to pay is that you have to work in a magnetic field where you can perform your particle hole transformation on the conduction band. And then you can make an exciton condensate that's stable in equilibrium. And that's what we're trying to study. Thanks a lot. Sorry I went late.
Yeah, I have a comment on this DC Josephson, or whether not DC Josephson, in fact, it's a tunneling peak. And so about 12 years ago, the Tonizzi and I studied this system. And we thought this system should have all the property of a superfluid, neutral superfluid, including Joseon effect and the counter. So despite some controversy, we still think this conduction peak observed is a DC Joseon effect. One way to settle the issue is to look at the other properties of the superfluid, and like this counterflow. Still, there may be some subtlety, but in general, it looks like there is a superfluid counterflow. And the third thing about the superfluid properties is the AC Joseon effect.
Right.
And since the peak you observe is so narrow, like a microvolt, so one may see some AC Joseon effect, maybe like 200 megahertz or gigahertz. I don't know whether that is accessible or not. If one can do something like that.
Unfortunately, she had to graduate. An undergraduate is attempting to do that exact experiment.
I mean,
we are irradiating our tunnel junctions with of order a few gigahertz, because as you point out, one microvolt is a lot smaller than a few gigahertz. And she had to graduate, so she's not quite done. But we'll try and see.
Yeah. If I see all these phenomena, then it's a kind of a...
Well, no.
It's a superfluid.
As you said, this is a contentious subject. And I'm not going to resolve the contention, but I can say two things. One is that we don't see a Joseon effect. We see a finite width to this thing. That's a fact. What's going to happen in the AC conductivity measurement with the radiation coming on, I think is going to be a tough sell, because there will be photon-assisted tunneling in this system, which will lead to anomalies in the IV curve. These replicas, photon-assisted replicas, these replicas are going to occur in the same place that the Shapiro steps would occur if the system were behaving like an honest-to-God Joseon junction. Unfortunately, we don't have a 2. We're missing this factor of 2 that you have in Cooper pairs, which helps you distinguish between photon-assisted tunneling and Shapiro steps. They're all going to be in the same place. So if they come out and they're rigorously vertical on the voltage axis, and we can tell the guys at NIST we have a new voltage standard and a resistance standard in the same sample, then we'll be in good shape. But if we just see wiggles in the IV curve, which is what I'm going to bet we're going to see, then we're not going to be able to say.
So, I mean, I don't think it's a strict analogy to the Joseon effect when you're doing this tunneling. I mean, I think most of us would probably agree on that. But you can set up, in principle, something which is a strict analogy, which is to break it into two
right
two
in the plane.
And
right, I didn't make this point, but you're absolutely right. There should be a Joseon effect if we make an in-plane junction, which we then drive in counterflow. Right, so we could make the counterflow measurement with a barrier in the plane and try to do that
are you intending to try that?
Yes, we are definitely intending to try. That is very, very much something we want to do.
So in the neutral bilayer Josephson junction systems, we know that the kinetic energy of the in-plane motion actually is very important, because that energy is less of kinetic energy of this phase, this phi you wrote down, is actually less than the two terms, the tunneling or the derivative kinetic energy across the plane. That
you mean at zero magnetic field in a conventional electron.
Well, for the neutrals, I'm not familiar with these charged systems. And in those cases, that we actually know, even in a balanced situation, this balance is a dynamical balance in the sense that current is flowing from one layer to the other at some locations, but it's going opposite direction at other locations. So that the net overall ground state corresponding to no net flow. So I was wondering, in your system, is it possible to make this measurement at the different locations across this plane?
Of course. Whether one would learn something from that, I'm not so sure. I mean, what I'm convinced of is that the size of our sample is much larger than the disorder length scale that's present, much larger, factor of 100. So I think that, unless I'm misunderstanding your question, that if we move our sample around, as we have done, made many, many different samples, we won't see anything materially different. because we're not able, we're averaging over many, many disordered regions.
Maybe I should use the microphone.
No, you need the attenuator.
No, that's fine. I just wanted to add to that contention that Shaogang was talking about. I think the tunneling peak, I mean, I agree with Matthew completely, although it's very, very interesting and exciting, and I don't know what it is. I do not see it as an exact analog of DC Josephson effect, because you, as you emphasized very carefully, you need some tunneling amplitude to do the tunneling measurement, and you need finite delta SAS, which is taking one away from the spontaneous interlayer collapse. On the other hand, the excitonic experiment, the counterflow experiment, I think it's very convincing that it's a superfluid, but perhaps with the costless Thales temperature zero or very low, So it's a superfluid, but probably it's not a DC Josephson.
I mean, look, I couldn't agree with you guys more about this. I've said what I think is true from our experiment. One thing that, for those of you that haven't thought a lot about this particular system, and are wondering why are we arguing about whether it is a Josephson junction or not? One thing to keep in mind that's very zero order level, is that in a Josephson junction, if you pull the layers apart, you have two superconductors. In this system, if I pull the layers apart, I don't have any superconductors. All I have is two-dimensional electron gases, each at filling factor of half. So this is one unit. It's not the same. Now, I'm not going to come out on one side or the other of this theoretical debate until we've done an experiment that's going to render it moot.
I'd like to really make a comment here. It's that the dynamics of interlayer tunneling is exactly the same as a two-coupled superconducting thin film. When you have a two-coupled superconducting thin film with an area like a coupling, then things become very tricky. But if a two-coupled superconducting thin film only have a point coupling, then you really have the ordinary Josephson junction and the Josephson effect. And here, the situation you have is looks like you have area coupling. But on the other hand, because of the phase are all random, and maybe there's a coupling constant that's kind of fluctuating.
What will you want
symmetry?
Yeah,
so it's not being
broken.
So
it's
the equation of motion is identical.
Everything is Newton's laws. Okay.
Simple question. Have you tried the counterflow experiment with two different loops rather than feeding back?
With two rings?
In other words, not the same electrons coming back to the layer.
Not the same electrons.
Is that?
I'm not sure right. What you mean. Two different circuits somehow,
different
completely
circuits.
Independent
two
of one
batteries.
Another. I'll just say no. I don't know what it means exactly what you're asking, but we do take the electrons up into the room and massage them and measure them, and I'm quite sure they have no memory of what they were doing when they left the sample.
I just wanted to make one other point. I completely agree with Shaogang that one needs to do...
Wait a minute, you just completely agreed with
him. No, I'm agreeing with a different part of his statement. I do not agree this is like DC Josephson effect. As you know very well, from day one, I have said this is not DC Josephson effect. Okay, because there is finite tunneling. But I do agree that one needs to look at the totality of things. And so, for example, if you see Fraunhofer diffraction and all these other things, AC Josephson effect, all these things, then we have a complete picture emerging, and that's coming slowly. I mean, and
that's something that I can comment on, because I wanted from the very beginning to do the Fraunhofer experiment, and what we've been able to do, we have not succeeded, but what we have to do is to make a tunnel junction whose lateral dimensions are smaller than this disorder length scale, right? and that's going to be microns or submicron dimensions, and still see this tunneling peak. And we've managed to do it down to 2 microns. And at 2 microns, we still can resolve the peak, the coherent peak in the tunneling. And as a function of parallel field, we did not see any oscillations in that. However, Ian believes, my student believes, that we're still too large. that given the parallel field dependence and how rapidly that peak dropped off, the length scales you would get from that, he thinks if we had another factor of two, we might begin to see something. So it's an open question. It's very hard to do, because as we make these junctions narrower and narrower, the fact that they're not sharp edges becomes a serious problem.
Jim, that's really new. If it's not hard, many others could have done it.
To follow up on this idea of small system, if we use analogy as a Josephson junction, so this mode is like a Schweikart wave, and it's known that if you make a Schweikart wave in a small junction, gives you voltage peaks at some finite values. You don't just see, basically it's finite wavelengths which you start seeing. So did you see any sort of extra peaks at high energies in those?
We did not. I mean, I should probably sit down and talk with you about the Schweikart waves, but the way that I understand the Goldstone mode experiment with the magnetotunneling spectroscopy is that, in a sense, that's what we are seeing. That those modes and the Schweikart modes that you would talk about in normal, that's really the same thing. And we see them provided that the parallel field is producing wave vectors which if you invert to calculate a length is small compared to 2 microns. So everything kind of holds together. If we had another factor of 10 on the disorder length scale, we'd be in much better shape. I think we would see these things in the size junctions we've been able to make. But so far, we have not been able to do that.
Hi, Jim. I think the data on the superfluidity is really dramatic. So I was wondering whether you can also further produce some of the really hallmarks of the superfluid, i.e., I wonder whether you could take a hole in a sample to set up a persisting current for these type of flows. I understand then the current in upper layer with lower layer will be on opposite directions. I don't know whether there are ways to set it up and there are way to.
We have talked about this so many times.
No. But how about also looking for this?
Well, look, it's not going to be a persistent current. I can tell you the answer to that, because at least if it's a macroscopic device, a ring of comparable size to the sample, we know the conductivity is finite. So we're going to get a finite lifetime of a counterflowing current in two bilayer and a bilayer ring sample. But if we made smaller structures, again, smaller than some disorder length scale, then maybe we would see persistent currents. Then the question comes, as you say yourself, if you have counterpropagating electrical currents, you have no magnetic moment and no angular momentum from this. This is not like a superconducting wire in a loop or a tube full of liquid helium.
Why in a large sample you will not get it? On the other hand, here you have demonstrated that you can get some of the good.
All I've demonstrated is the conductivity becomes 1,000 times E squared over H. It's not any larger than that. So I don't hold out a lot of hope for doing that.
Okay. I'm just cutting into it. If you're not hungry, we can keep going.
Yeah, I'm just curious. So you mentioned that for large junctions, the critical current happens to be a few orders of magnitude below what you would get, let's say, from Josephson effect. So now for those small junctions, which are 2 microns in a side, so then, I mean, if there is some kind of averaging and the size of the
domain. That's a good question. I don't know. Unfortunately, can't tell you the answer.
Okay.
I don't know how things scale with areas. It's an extremely good question. I wish I did.
I wanted to come back to the issue of the costless Thales transition. Now, so from everything you've presented so far, you would expect one. I mean, or it's also maybe a question to the theorists. I mean, is that a well-settled issue of whether there should be a finite temperature costless Thales transition, and if so, what TC should
well,
be?
Well, there is tunneling in this system, so strictly speaking, no. But you know,
the short answer is no. Okay, yeah. I mean, I think it's well settled. There shouldn't be a, so when he says he sees disorder-induced free vortices,
let's imagine that
without disorder, there should be a costless Thales transition
in the limit of no tunneling.
Limit.
In the limit of no tunneling.
And it's small enough that presumably you would see hallmarks of it. But
that issue is settled. There was some papers questioning that.
It's a question of whether you have tunneling or not, what happens.
No, but without tunneling, without disorder,
without tunneling, without disorder, I think that is settled.
Okay. All right.
With disorder, which is definitely there, then, you know, what one believes is that the remnant of the coherent phase is something analogous to a gauge glass or a vortex glass phase in a superconductor. And in two dimensions, it's known that that thing is stable only at zero temperature. So there's no phase transition down to zero temperature. But
oh, in spite of the fact that the spin stiffness that you measure in experiment comes out to be what you would expect it to be.
Well, again, so there's some stiffness on some length scale.
On some length scale.
Mm-hmm. Not at the long
season, but, like the copper rack. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not true long range, but 1,000 angstrom.
Yeah.
This isn't a dirty sample. In a clean.
Do you have a clean? Do you have a clean sample?
No, he's unreasonable.
These are the best samples we can get.
I mean, a physical way to think about it.
I guarantee if I had a better one, I would use it.
On this point of agreement, you should stop.
Yeah.
It's a gauge.
All right. I think this is a good point to discuss over tea.
Yeah.
So let's thank Jim again.